The Buddha once said in the early teachings, those who see dependent arising see the Dharma. Those who see the Dharma see dependent arising. Have you all heard of dependent arising? Anybody not heard? Dependent arising is the Dharma. Dependent arising is the middle way. Basically, the Buddha spoke about dependent arising a lot. It was one of his unique and prominent teachings. So I'm so glad that some of you have never heard this, because this is a great thing to hear about, I think. Dependent arising, sometimes the Buddha would say, when asked what that means, he'd say, when there's this, this arises. When this comes to be, that comes to be. And when this ceases, that ceases. So that's one kind of simple explanation. In other words, everything that arises moment to moment, which is everything, arises dependent on other factors. Nothing exists independently. Nothing exists on its own. Everything arises dependently and ceases dependently on other phenomena, other appearances that also arise dependently on other things. And sometimes we say dependent co-arising, meaning like I'm arising here, you know, I'm basically here sitting on the seat now because you're here. So I wouldn't have come if you didn't come. So the arising of this person depends on the arising of you. And you might not have come if there wasn't a speaker giving a talk. You might have come for Zazen, but Zazen's over. Now we're sitting in a different way, right? And so you're listening dependent on my speaking, and I'm speaking dependent on your listening. We dependently co-arise. It's co means like mutual. Like causality doesn't work in just one direction. So co is nice, I think, too. Pratitya samudpada. Means dependent, and the sam means co, and utpada means arising. So that's a good translation, good complete translation. Dependent co-arising. Or interdependent co-production. Interdependent origination. And so there's many implications to this teaching. And it's an amazing teaching, I think, the more we look into it. So let's look into it some. Yes.
Well,
that's a big topic that's that's very related. And so we'll keep talking about this, but for now, just to give a brief answer, as you've heard about, there's these, you know, two truths, the conventional truth and the ultimate truth, and they're always a unity. You can't separate these two truths, and the conventional truth is often defined as dependent co-arising of all phenomena. All the myriad things of the world are all arising right now, and then they're ceasing, and then new ones are arising, dependent on other things. That's display, amazing, magical display of the world arising and ceasing. It's called the conventional truth. And by looking into these phenomena, dependent on other phenomena, we see that they don't exist on their own. And because they don't exist on their own, they're completely ungraspable. Everything is just this flux of interdependence with no separate things, actually. That's a big topic to unpack, which we have been unpacking and will continue to, but that ultimate truth is the truth of no arising and no ceasing and no phenomena. And so they're always conjoined. The very ultimate truth of emptiness is implied by dependent arising, and there's no emptiness apart from dependent arising, the conventional truth. So the oneness, you asked about oneness. Oneness, I would say, is the ultimate truth of where there's no phenomena, distinct phenomena, but there's oneness because of interdependent arising. So, simple?
Very simple. John Muir's definition, when we look at anything closely, we find that it's hitched to everything else in the universe.
Nice. There he said it. When we look at anything closely, we find that it's hitched to everything else in the universe. Now, very similar to dependent co-arising. Yeah. And everything is dependent on everything else, like ecologically speaking. You know, I think that's... we're learning more and more that that's the way the world is. And also, like, psychically speaking, in our mental world, every thought arises dependent on other thoughts. Every perception arises dependent on our, you know, senses and so on. So inner, outer worlds, every possible experience of life is dependent arising. Also called the middle way. And so sometimes the Buddha would give some kind of like story, sort of reasonings to look into how this is so. Well, we're already doing this, I think, already and tonight. But sometimes the reasonings get more complex, and sometimes they're quite simple. So I think we have a pretty simple story tonight from the Buddha. But as a prelude to that, I just came across this... these words from my friend and teacher Karl Brunholzl, a practitioner and expounder of the middle way. I happened to run into him in Nepal, even though he lives in America. So we had some great conversations over there. He says, so there's this middle way reasoning. Some of you know about this, teachings of Nagarjuna and so on. But it starts with the Buddha. But sometimes, I know some people, including myself, sometimes, just have a hard time with it. It seems so, like, heady and conceptual. And isn't Zen practice about, like, letting go of all this conceptual thinking? Yes, and he says, Carl says, a striking feature of this middle way reasoning or analysis is how much emotional resistance it can produce in us. Normally, we don't really want to get into all these reasonings and deconstructions of concepts, and we find all kinds of wonderful rationales for why this is pointless, counterproductive, too intellectual, and so on. The main reason we do this is that the more active part of our ignorance doesn't want us to look at ourselves, he claims. I don't know if this is always the case. Sometimes it might just be like, my brain is tired. I have a headache today. Can't we just sit? But sometimes I think it might be like this. We feel like it maybe is pointing to something, but it takes some effort. And maybe we don't, what it's pointing to is maybe too much. So part of our ignorance doesn't want us to look at ourselves. We do not really want to have our belief systems questioned, probably because we have some feeling that they might not be in such perfect touch with reality as we would like them to be. We like our little world as intact and secure as we can possibly make it, or at least pretend so. So I think this is a challenging encouragement I feel to let's be willing to sometimes look into this, and it does take some effort. He goes on to say, it can be overwhelming to realize that this middle way reasoning is not just an intellectual game, but can deeply affect us at the basic level of our personal and emotional existence. So, though it can be complex, I think if we lose sight of how it's actually supposed to be transforming our relationship with ourselves and the world, then we've lost the point. And it's easy to lose the point, so let's proceed slowly and carefully. Here's a story from the old sutras, the connected discourses, a lot of them, of the Buddha. The connected discourses, this is the Pali canon, the old early teachings. It's a section called the Book of Causation, which is like, when this arises, that arises. The translator even says, it could have been called the Book of Dependent Co-arising, but the title was maybe too long and, unwieldy for the translators, so it's shorter to just say causation. It's a book about a section of these discourses about dependent co-arising. And there's this one sutra that goes like this. Thus have I heard. Once the Blessed One was living at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove, the squirrel sanctuary. Ken and I visited. Well, it's the same town as Vulture Peak, Rajagaha, but at least some of us, after Vulture Peak, we stopped by the bamboo grove down at the bottom of the hill. I think the group got kind of dispersed at that point. But there's a bamboo grove that's still there. And I didn't see any squirrels, but it's a peaceful, shady grove on a hot, sunny day where the Buddha liked to spend time when Vulture Peak was getting too hot for the top. Then in the morning, the Blessed One dressed and taking his bowl and robe entered Rajagaha, or Rajagir, for alms. The naked ascetic Kashyapa saw the Blessed One coming in the distance. I just think it must have been an amazing time to live at this time in the Buddha, when there's Buddha and his Sangha practicing in the grove, but then there's all these like naked ascetics wandering around. And this, as there still are in India, places like Varanasi, ash-covered, dreadlocked yogis wandering around. It's just such an ancient culture. So one of them, and this is, I guess Kashyapa was a common name, so this is not the same Mahakashyapa that's our first Zen ancestor, although he appears in many of these early sutras. This is one of the Kashyapas. I think Kashyapa means, according to Keizan Zenji, means drinker of light. So he's a light drinker. He approached the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him, and when they had concluded their greetings and cordial talk, he stood to one side and said, "We would like to ask Master Gotama about a certain point, if he would grant us the favor of answering our question," Kashyapa said. And the Buddha said, "This is not the right time for a question, Kashyapa. We have entered among the houses. We're on the alms round in the village of Rajagaha now, and we like to just do this as a silent walking practice. So let's not get into a whole like big debate like in front of the houses. It's not the time. Let's sit down later." Kashyapa is like, he wants to ask something. So a second and a third time, the naked ascetic Kashyapa said to the Blessed One, "We'd like to ask Master Gotama about a certain point, if he would grant us the favor of answering our question." And the Buddha said, "This is not the right time for a question, Kashyapa. We have entered among the houses." Then the naked ascetic Kashyapa said to the Blessed One, "We don't wish to ask Master Gotama much. Just a brief question. It'll just take a minute." And the Buddha said, "Then ask what you want, Kashyapa." And as the commentators say, this was common in the Buddha's time. People asked three times. Buddha sometimes wouldn't even give a teaching until he was asked three times. So maybe it's not so appropriate to go on like this, because some traditions, even I know in Chinese Zen tradition, I've seen sometimes, like before the Dharma talk, somebody will like ritually come up and like kind of bow to the speaker and say, "Please give us a Dharma talk." And I think maybe it's to enact this kind of feeling of like, we shouldn't just talk unless we're like thoroughly invited. So, but I won't leave right now. Let's keep going since we started. And I apologize if you'd rather not hear. Ask what you want, Kashyapa. "How is it, Master Gotama? Is suffering created by oneself?" Suffering's a big issue, right, for the Buddha. He only teaches suffering and the end of suffering and dependent co-arising. So, how is it? Is suffering created by oneself? Like, how does suffering come to be? This is important to all the practitioners in the world, I think. We want to relieve suffering of ourselves and others. Is it created by oneself? "Not so, Kashyapa," the Blessed One said. "Then, Master Gotama, is suffering created by another?" Not so, Kassapa, the Blessed One said. How is it then, Master Gotama, is suffering created both by oneself and by another? Not so, Kassapa, the Blessed One said. Then, Master Gotama, has suffering arisen fortuitously, being created neither by oneself nor by another? Not so, Kassapa, the Blessed One said. This is the four possibilities. I've been exhausted. Suffering is not created by oneself. It's not created by another. It's not created by some combination of oneself and another. And it's not created fortuitously, and I think this means like randomly, like without a cause. It doesn't just arise without a cause. Spontaneously or randomly. Neither from oneself nor from another. Well, poor Kassapa says, how is it then, Master Gotama? Is there then no suffering? I might have expected him to say, that's right, there actually is no suffering. But actually, he says in this case, it's not that there's no suffering, Kassapa, there is suffering. It's the first noble truth. Then is it that Master Gotama does not know or see suffering? And the Buddha says, it's not that I do not know and see suffering, Kassapa. I do know suffering, and I do see suffering. This is getting strange now. What kind of suffering is this? Where does it come from? I think that's the question, right? Is where does it come from? It doesn't come from oneself, from another, from both or from neither. What's the origin of suffering? And then Kassapa says, to repeat this, I think this is partly because people were trying to memorize these sutras, so there's a lot of repetition, but it helps in case you were spacing out the first part. Now Kassapa reviews their conversation. Well, whether you're asked, how is it, Master Gotama? Is suffering created by oneself? Is it created by another? Is it created by both? Is it created by neither? In each case, you say, not so, Kassapa. When you're asked, how is it then, Master Gotama? Is there no suffering? You say, it's not that there's no suffering, Kassapa. There is suffering. When asked, then, is it that Master Gotama does not know and see suffering? You say, it's not that I do not know and see suffering, Kassapa. I know suffering. I see suffering. Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One explain suffering to me. Let the Blessed One teach me about suffering. And the commentators that are looking at each detail, they say, notice that before he was saying Master Gotama, and this is the first time he says Blessed One or Bhagavan, and it said that the Buddhas wait to be asked three times, so that people who want to ask a question get more interested, and they also develop respect. Because if they just answer right away, then people are like, oh, okay, I got it. Or they just immediately like just get into an argument or something. So it's kind of like, so that they don't get into superficial conversations. It's like, do you really want to know this? No, I'll just ask once. It's not worth asking a second time. If it's worth asking three times, then it's like, okay, this just seems important. Let's talk. And so now Kassapa feels like there's something here, maybe. Please teach me about suffering. And the Buddha says, Kassapa, if one thinks the one who acts is the same as the one who experiences the result of the action, then one asserts, with reference to one existing from the beginning, suffering is created by oneself. So that's maybe a little bit hard. So an example would be like, this happens like all the time. I have some view I'm holding on to. I like holding on to views. Actually, I hate holding on to views, but I do it constantly anyway. Why? Well, I think that's what the sutra is kind of about, somewhat. But we do, right? We hold on. I'm holding on to a view, and then somebody else might have a different view, and then we start having a kind of a, like an argument, and then I get upset, and I say some harsh words to the other person. Well, you know, because I was holding a view and they were holding a view, takes two to tango. and now maybe I let it get to the point where I say, "You schmuck," and they go, "Well, I'm out of here then. If you're gonna call me names like that," and I might say, "Well, go ahead." Hopefully it doesn't get this bad, but it might sometimes, right? I think anything we hurt somebody. This is just an example of we hurt somebody, and then later we feel regret. I didn't need to call him a schmuck. Actually, that was a little over the top. Actually, I feel actually ashamed and kind of guilt about this. It may be much worse than calling someone a schmuck, or maybe less, depending on our inclinations. We can easily feel ashamed about something we've done. I think that's what this example here. We do something, and then later we experience the result of something that we did, like yesterday, and now I'm suffering because of what yesterday's Kokyo said to somebody. Sound familiar? Like this kind of thing, right? Anytime we're suffering due to something that we, some way that we harmed another, and now we feel ashamed. I think that's what this is actually pointing to. So now, with that in mind, the Buddha says, if one thinks that the one who acts, the one who said, "You schmuck," is the same as the one who experiences the result, "Oh, I really feel ashamed, I feel awful now," the next day, that's the one who experiences the result, right? Yesterday, the one who said the schmuck, and today's one, "I feel so ashamed." If one thinks that those are the same, with reference to one existing from the beginning, I think we're talking about some continuous thread called a self that we feel like came to be like when we were born, or maybe when we as far back as we can remember, that was me. We feel like there's some continuous self, don't we? This is another one of the Buddha's main teachings, is that it's not quite like that, even though it feels very much like that. So, reference to one existing from the beginning, this old sutra language for saying, maybe to try to retranslate a little bit. Kashapa, if one thinks the one who said "you schmuck" yesterday is the same as the one who's feeling really ashamed and horrible today, then one asserts with reference to like a continuous self existing from the beginning, suffering is created by oneself. That was his first question. Can you follow? Yeah.
Let me try it. So if you make that presumption, mm-hmm. then suffering is created by the self.
Yeah.
If that's the construct mm-hmm. that you're thinking of.
That's right. Yeah.
And I presume there's going to be other...
Yeah, there's going to be some other...
Examples what would make each of these true, which are conditioned.
Yeah.
Depending on how you're...
Yeah. Or what makes actually... why suffering is not created by oneself or by another or by both or by neither. Remember, this is what we're, these are the four ways that suffering does not arise, the Buddha said, and now he's explaining why.
Okay.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if I'm making that premise, then he's saying in this first example, well, it is created by the self if this is how you're holding it. I should wait until I hear the full logic.
I think he's saying if you think that suffering is created by oneself, that means that you believe that there's a continuous self, that it was you yesterday who said you schmuck. It's the same self as today that's feeling ashamed.
If you believe that you create it, then that's because you believe that.
And I would propose that this is the way 99% of us actually do think. That the other examples that we'll hear now are quite rare, actually. I think this is the norm. I think this way. In fact, I think that's mostly this shame thing that we feel is so much about me, right? It's like I feel ashamed of, that's their language, I feel ashamed of myself. And we really feel as if there's somebody there. And I mean, I'm talking about yesterday, but I think this also ties in to distant past, things we did way long ago, maybe even as a kid. And just to bring in another example that I think would apply here too is I think we're really saying created by oneself. What I was just thinking of was like childhood trauma. Now, we don't say that was somebody like really abuses us as a child, and then, you know, 50 years later, that situation's long gone, but the seeds of that experience are very much alive in us, right? This is, I think, what trauma is it's like something that stays with us in some like deep cellular, I mean, it's mind we're talking about, but I think very deep like center of the brain, like the most primitive emotional kind of brain that's not rational, right? I think this is why it's so hard to work with trauma, because rational reasoning, like, it's long gone, it's nothing, it's fine now, but that doesn't help because it's so deeply held. So that might not apply here, because we're not saying that suffering was caused by oneself, right? But it's related in that it seems like that thread, that happened to me when I was 3 years old or something, seems like it's the same me at 50 years old. I think that part does hold true. You're gritting your teeth?
No, I'm just holding back on talking.
Okay, well, let's keep going. anyway, we can think of lots of examples how we suffer due to some me, continuous me. So suffering is created by oneself. Let's go back to the example of the me that said you schmuck yesterday. When one asserts thus, this amounts to eternalism. So the Buddha had talked about these kind of views at that time. Eternalism meaning like there's some indestructible essence that had no beginning and has no end, and it can never be destroyed. This is like a philosophical view called eternalism, and that's what the view of a permanent eternal self is, like eternalism. That's an extreme view. So the Buddha says it's too much in one direction. But Kāsapa, if one thinks the one who acts is one person, the one who experiences the result is another, totally separate person, then one asserts with reference to one stricken by feeling, I think that just means when one is that person feeling the result, suffering is created by another. So it might be a kind of, we were thinking of like another person. I usually think of as another, but the Buddha's going, we're just talking about a version of yesterday's Kokyo was another person. When we, not today's. This suffering now is created by a different person from yesterday. And I think this is maybe very unusual. I think most people don't think in this way, but people who start hearing these Buddhist teachings about no self and so on, and really start contemplating them and considering them, they might start to think this way. So I think this is like a kind of practitioner's view, meaning like there's no connection between me sitting here now and yesterday's self. And you can imagine the dangers in this kind of view. Because like, you know, I really hurt somebody yesterday, but today it's like, well, that's fine, because that wasn't me. There's no self that connects me with yesterday's Kokyo. So I'm sorry if yesterday's Kokyo hurt you, but don't blame me. It wasn't me. It was yesterday's Kokyo. This is one implication of like a misunderstanding of no self. We might even call it like, it's related to like emptiness sickness, or you know, Zen sickness. Not, maybe it doesn't sound so elaborate, but I think this is what it's a kind of, there's no self in a kind of extreme way. There's no connection between things at all, and therefore there's no responsibility. Right? In this kind of, this version of no self, there'd be no responsibility. There's this fresh moment, completely new, not dependent on any other past moment of self.
Is it responsibility a kind of a form of internalism?
Responsibility?
Responsibility?
It could be. I think it could, if we reify it too much and we have a big kind of like shame and guilt trip around the responsibility, then I think it would be like eternalism and it's like responsibility gone too far. Mm-hmm. But I think true responsibility is the middle way, mm-hmm. which we'll get to in here. But yeah, I think true responsibility is based on this view of interdependence. But you know, reified responsibility, which usually results in feeling like I'm always failing in my responsibility and I feel so bad about that. Now we're getting into eternalism, actually, which is common. I get into that. Too responsible, right? The one who acts is another from one who experiences the result. This is the view, suffering is created by another. When one asserts thus, this amounts to annihilationism or nihilism, the other extreme view. If one views eternalism is like there's a continuous thread of self, and annihilationism is like there's no connection between today's Kokyo and yesterday's Kokyo. Everything is just spontaneously arising. Doesn't an enlightened person fall into cause and effect or not? Well, no, there's just this moment, totally fresh and like, whoops, such a person falls into a body of a wild fox, as Nettie told us the other day. Annihilationism is another word for this kind of like emptiness, sickness, it's not true emptiness, but it's an extreme version of emptiness that's gone too far into the other extreme called annihilationism or nihilism, meaning like, I think it's called annihilationism because it's like, yesterday's self is annihilated. Mm-hmm. Yesterday's self is gone, like, and there's no connection. And as we sometimes talked about, you know, this is related to the issues of rebirth throughout lives. If we get kind of like a little strict with this, we might say, if we believe that when this body dies, and the mind as we know it ceases, that's the end, cease, there's no effect after that, which I think is the view of modern kind of secular materialism. It's just the brain, the mind is based on a material brain. When it's gone, that's the end. I would say that's a view of annihilationism, I think, or the Buddha would say. So now we've gone over these two. Without veering towards either of these extremes, the Tathagata teaches the Dharma by the middle. The Buddha teaches the middle way, free from these extremes of a continuous self and no connection between me and the, you know, this body and mind and yesterday's body and mind that we call Kokyo. Without veering towards either of these extremes, the Tathagata, the Buddha, teaches the Dharma by the middle, teaches the Dharma of the middle way, the middle way, quote, Buddha quoting himself, with ignorance as a condition, volitional formations arise. You know, with ignorance of the middle way, volitional actions arise, like, I have this view and you have that view, and you're wrong, so you're a schmuck. Oh, I shouldn't have said it. This is called saying you're a schmuck. Like, I guess the impulse to say you're a schmuck is the volitional formation, and I think actually saying it too is part of volitional formations based on ignorance of the middle way, and you know, dependent on volitional formations, consciousness arises. This is a standard, you know, version of dependent arising that, without getting too into the details, consciousness arises. Mainly, let's say, dualistic consciousness arises, dependent on volitional formations. Dependent on dualistic consciousness, name and form arise. And today I just like to think of that as like the way we name, the way the mind names forms is the result of dualistic consciousness. That's not the way it's usually put, but it's only, I think, a way to look at it. Dependent on dualistic consciousness, the mind starts naming forms. You're wrong and I'm right and you're a schmuck. Dependent on name and form, the sense faculties arise. So now it's not just like mental consciousness. Now we have the complexity of eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, all dualistically relating to an external world. Dependent on these sense faculties, contact arises. Meaning like the eye contacts a color and the ear contacts a sound and so on. Dependent on contact, feeling arises. As soon as you need that contact to have a feeling, right, of pleasant or unpleasant. And as soon as you have that, dependent on feeling, craving arises. Well, of course we want the pleasant. Are we crazy or something? Who would want the unpleasant? Dependent on craving, grasping arises. Well, it's like a solidification of craving. Like, I want the pleasant, and I'm going to get it. Grab it. Dependent on grasping, becoming arises. Now we're like, I'm the one who got it. I become the one who got it. Yes. And then dependent on becoming, birth arises. And dependent on birth, aging, sickness, and death arise. Dependent on aging, sickness, and death, and the whole mass of suffering, ignorance arises. depend on ignorance, karmic formations, and the cycle goes round and round endlessly, called samsara. So that's suffering arises dependent on conditions. And then with the cessation of ignorance, there's the cessation of karmic formations, and so on through these 12 links. When all this was said, the naked ascetic Kāsapa said to the Blessed One, "Magnificent, Venerable Sir, magnificent, Venerable Sir, the Dharma has been made clear in many ways by the Blessed One, as though he were turning upright what had been turned upside down, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. I take refuge in the Blessed One, and in the Dharma, and in the Sangha of monks. May I receive the going forth from the worldly life under the Blessed One. May the Blessed One ordain me." And the Buddha says, "Well, we have this guideline in our Sangha that one who's formerly belonged to another ascetic sect, who wants to be ordained in the Buddhist Sangha, has a kind of probationary period for 4 months. Why? Maybe just because they have all these other views that they have to kind of like let go of, or maybe have too many arguments with the Buddha's disciples." It's interesting. There's one of those. It's in the Vinaya rules, right? But yet, even though we have this rule, individual differences are acknowledged by me. In other words, as the Buddha, like, I can make exceptions. And then Kāsapa says, "Well, if you have this 4 month probation period, then I'll be on probation for 4 years." And then if the monks are satisfied, then they can ordain me. So it's just a nice little thing about how patient he is. Right? I don't mind waiting. Like, I don't want to like push you about this kind of thing. I'll wait 4 years. And then the Buddha says, "Okay, then I'll ordain you right now." It's a little like extra part of the story, but it's kind of a fun little part, I think. If he was like, "Really, 4 months?" Then maybe the Buddha would be like, "Okay, 4 years. Like, "No, 4 years, 10 years, no problem. Okay, now it's fine." My teacher's kind of like that too, with when people do push him about ordination, and usually the ones who are like get that way, he like just doesn't really respond to them for like a long time, and those who are just kind of bring it up, and he says, "Oh, I'll consider it," and then maybe like pretty soon he'll say, "Well, yeah, let's do that." So Buddhas are like that. So then just to finish the story, not long after that, dwelling alone, diligent, ardent, resolute, the Venerable Kāsapa, by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge in this very life, entered and dwelt in that unsurpassed goal of the holy life for the sake of which people rightly go forth from the worldly life. He directly knew birth. This is my last birth. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. Now there is no more becoming. And the Venerable Kāsapa became one of the arhats, the noble disciples. And they all lived happily ever after. So there's not so much time now, but is there anything to just clarify about that story? Yes.
So is the answer, it depends? I'm not just being cute here, I'm serious. I mean,
well, it depends.
It was a big, valid question.
Yeah. And so the middle way, free from these extremes, is I will teach you the Dharma by the middle, free from these extremes, basically dependent arising. And even if you put aside that whole formula of dependent on this, there's this, dependent on this, this 12-fold chain of causation that, you know, we very briefly went through, I think just actually the teaching of dependent arising itself, that middle way, is the answer. Suffering, the suffering of the one who feels ashamed today, this one who feels ashamed today is not the same as yesterday's Kokyo who said you schmuck, and not totally different from yesterday's Kokyo. Today's Kokyo depends on yesterday's. That's the key thing. That he didn't say explicitly, so yeah. The one who receives the result depends on the one who set the causation in motion. And therefore, there's no self in there, right? There's no threat of self, so there's no eternalism, but there's also just, there's not the spontaneous arising of like a random me right now, with everything is illusion before this. No, there's this, today's me depends on yesterday's me, so that dependent relationship is the teaching of no self, the true teaching of no self, which is not nihilism or eternalism. So it's only, you know, it's a story we can actually consider and apply to our experience next time we're suffering, which might be soon. I think that's the time to apply it. And we might consider it so we remember to apply it, but where is this coming from, and what was the one, especially if it's around this guilt shame issue, what's our relationship to yesterday's self? And therefore there's responsibility is part of this interdependent connection, because I'm closely related to yesterday's me without self. Yeah, last quick question.
Acting out of this idealized self, this is when the suffering comes.
Yes.
So
I think either extreme, either that there's a continuous idealized self that actually carries through from the day we were born, that's where most of our suffering comes from, according to the Buddha. But then the other extreme of like, we might say, as a cure to be free from suffering, well, there's no self and I'm totally free from everything I did before, nothing to be ashamed of. I think there is suffering there, and that's a kind of a spiritual suffering because it's disconnected. But this interdependent suffering is in a way a kind of beautiful suffering. It's a very natural suffering. How could it be any other way? This suffering depends on conditions, and the conditions can cease, and then the suffering ceases, and we can work with it. We can work with it. Yeah. Yeah, so those extreme views are always suffering, and the middle way is always free from suffering. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.